Ah, there's a sound we hear. Well, once it gets warm.
If it ever warms up, they'll be back.
If it ever warms up, they'll be back. Oh, Frog. Scott Craven back with us once again. I'm Larry Mueller. Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife with him. And, you know, frogs, those spring peepers, that's a kind of a sure sign of spring. And I did hear some spring peepers a week or so ago at in Lodi, when I was in Lodi one evening, and it was fun to hear.
The chorus frogs and a few peepers cranked up pretty early in my little backyard water feature, but they've been strangely silent for the last few days.
Oh, well, we can talk about frogs with Scott Craven. He's a wildlife emeritus professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Comes by on the first Wednesday of the month to talk about what's going on in the world of wildlife. Certainly, we always look forward to hearing what you have to say. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. And email us at ideas@wpr.org. And, you know, they're making a lot of noise. They have a good reason to make a lot of noise, don't they?
The frogs?
Yeah.
Well, it's that time of year. If you want to pass on your genetic heritage to the next generation, you better be singing if you're a male, and that's what they're doing. And I think if we can finally get out of the 40s, there'll be lots of frogs cranked up here. There's certainly plenty of water. Amphibians have to be happy about the water situation. So I think we'll start to get more toads, which is what we started out with.
Yeah.
And, oh, and then leopard frogs and a few other odds and ends. And then the big guys, green frogs, and they won't come on until midsummer. But they'll be out. It just has to warm up a little bit. But I did get a picture on email 2 days ago, first morels. So that's another important sign of spring. Now, they won't be growing much in this cold. But with plenty of moisture and a few warm days, it should be pretty good mushroom hunting.
Yeah, it should be. And for those turkey hunters, you know, that's a good second part of the turkey hunt, at least it has been in my experience, is to come upon some morel mushrooms.
The way things are going for me this year, it's going to be the only part of turkey hunting because the turkeys have been almost as quiet as the frogs and at least where I've been, not particularly numerous. So we'll see. There's still plenty of time left. Today marks the start of the third of the six turkey hunting weeks. So we're still only 1/3 in. There'll be plenty of time yet.
Plenty of time. Fred in Madison has something I think that might relate to turkeys. Let's go there.
Yes. Hi, I'm here. This is Fred.
Hi, Fred.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hi. Well, I'm in my mid-60s, actually late 60s, and I think seagulls have become the most common, one of the most common birds on the west side of Madison. When I was a little kid on the west side of Madison in the late 50s, I don't remember ever seeing a seagull. And when I went with my parents to Door County in 58, I discovered seagulls. I just didn't know about them. There were blue jays, there were starlings, and there were robins. The starlings were considered like intruders or kind of the bad birds. But now, especially in the far west side of Madison around West Town, where it's all concrete and parking lot,
they're everywhere.
Of course.
Yeah, they're everywhere, aren't they, Fred? Well, I tell you what, we are on the 7th floor of Vilas Hall, and I was in my office. Jill and I share an office, and it was fun to be looking down on seagulls that were swooping a couple of floors below us. There's a heck of a lot of seagull out there.
Well, apparently the last couple of days, both on the national news in the morning and on one of our local news broadcasts, they've got gulls that are regularly sitting in front of the traffic cams on a couple of big buildings. One was here in town, one was elsewhere, and they're getting this full-frame shot of the same gull every time they try and look at the traffic. So, but as far as all the birds that Fred was seeing around in plowed agricultural fields, there are a lot of gulls, and that's a function of their ability to do very well in a human-dominated landscape. They like our landfills. They like plowed ag ground where they can find worms and grubs and whatnot. And they'll all move off to nest into water bodies once crops are in the ground.
Yeah, but there does seem to be more of them
there are
than there was 20 years ago, for sure. Well, we I wanted to mention the Natural Resources Foundation because there's some field, you know, a lot of the field trips that they put on every year are likely full, but there's, you were telling me that there's quite a few that are still open.
Well, I'm not sure about quite a few. They have a huge lineup of field trips this year. There were over 200. They put out a very nicely produced bulletin that lists all of those, and a lot of them fill up very quickly. But I noticed on email a couple of days ago there were still six or seven, including some attractive ones like frog calls and birding, that were still had some openings in May and then more later on. So if folks are maybe first-timers, never heard of the Natural Resources Foundation field trips, I think they would enjoy them greatly. And they just have to go to Field Trip. Is it Field Trip or Field Trips? I think it's Field Trip at Wisconservation, wisconservation.org.
Yeah.
So go to the NRF website, and they could Google it too, and then that'll have
find
instructions on how to sign up.
And we had some folks on from the foundation, talked about it here about a few weeks back. I think that was the day that they were to, maybe it was a week or two before they were going to open it up. And there was quite a bit of interest that day. And I'll tell you what, one of those birding trips, I've gone on a couple of those, and they're always a lot of fun. And there's always somebody that is a whole heck of a lot smarter than I am.
That's why they're leading the field trips. And plus, they know where to go. And if things go well, it's premature. But on a later show, they're trying to set up one for me to lead in early September on wildlife identification.
Oh, cool.
And it'll be part on campus and part in the field.
In
Madison, we're trying to set that up for a Saturday, and people can watch for that too. But more to follow on that.
Yeah, Rick in Oshkosh has something for us. Rick, hi.
Good morning, Larry. Great program, and we enjoy listening to you. This is the first time I ever called in.
Well,
and I'd like to ask about the Yahara River, because we used to work at UW Hospital years ago before we retired, and we're now up in Oshkosh, and Lake Winnebago is getting pretty high, and we're talking about 35,000 cubic feet per second moving into the lake and going out of the lake. So the lake's hanging in there, but docks are gradually going underwater.
Yeah.
How are they doing on the Yahara River?
As far as I know, and Larry's closer to the lakes than I, but things are actually going pretty good, and certainly better than with the flooding of last summer when there were lots of problems and damage. So far they've been able to keep up with inflow. And the Wisconsin River, of course, is going by to the northwest. That's not affecting us. And all what seems like a lot of rain has actually been either just north or just southeast of us. And, you know, we're only getting tenths of inches. So no downpours. So I think things are still okay.
Yeah, they're still. And there are some plans in the works to do some dredging and improve the flow and out of Wabisa, I believe. So there's... You know, they're not out of the woods yet on it, but things are okay for now anyway, Rick. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Todd and Delavan emailed to ask, how long after robins build a nest do they lay eggs? We have a pair trying to build a nest above our front door under the porch roof. Every day when he gets home, he has to climb up a ladder and clean it out. He's tried onions, garlic, and red pepper. Good spot for a nest, just not right where you have to walk in and out of the...
Well, as long as they're keeping after it, if an egg's laid, then they're kind of sunk. They've got to
leave
things alone. But as long as they're cleaning out the nesting material, but rather than do that every day and be balancing around on the ladder, a whole lot easier, I think, not knowing the architecture, to screen that area off with some bird netting or plastic sheeting or something until the robins decided, maybe we'll go somewhere else and solve that problem that way.
Yeah, and then you do it once and it's solved for good. Yeah. So we have the status of the white-tailed deer report. Some data on that, which you were surprised. You were quizzing me a little bit, and I was failing in my answers.
Well, I was a little surprised too, Larry. The Quality Deer Management Association, which is a large national organization of landowners and hunters, people who are concerned about deer, apparently put this report together annually. And in the 2019 report, which had data from the 17-18 hunting season, they talked about all sorts of things. And one of the most interesting things for me was numbers. Thinking only about the Midwest, Northeast, and Southeast in the United States, those three regions hold about 97% of both the deer and the deer hunters. So how many deer were harvested or killed, shot, whatever, in that season of 17-18? 5.7 million.
Yeah, I guess 2.5.
and for the first time in probably 25 years, it was the first time that the harvest of antlerless deer or bucks, exceeded that of antlerless deer, only by 100,000, but still exceeded it. Furthermore, you've hunted in Wisconsin for a long time and understand, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, most of the bucks harvested were yearlings.
Yep.
Now, nationally, 34% of the antlered deer, the bucks that I just mentioned in that 2.9 million, were 3.5 years old or older.
Yeah.
Which most hunters would consider a trophy animal, you know, a big deer. So the percentage of yearlings now, which was very high in Wisconsin in years gone by, is now down nationally to about a third of the harvest. But there were a couple of other quick things. Bow hunting is clearly on the rise. Use of tracking dogs is on the rise. Here, opening day. 10 to 27% of the total deer harvest occurs in that one day nationally. Minnesota's number one at 27%, right on the button. The Midwest has the most bow hunters. 41% of hunters harvested one or more deer.
Almost half.
Yep. Deer vehicle collisions are climbing. Estimated for that year of 17-18, 1.3 million deer hit by cars, and that's what was reported.
Wow. So there's you're telling me there's a lot of deer out there.
There are a lot of deer out there, and CWD, chronic wasting disease, has been confirmed in somewhere around 30 states now. Tennessee's the most recent addition to that unfortunate circumstance. But bottom line was, people are keeping track of this stuff, and for people interested in deer because they hunt them, hit them with vehicles, or just like to see them, there are a lot of them out there.
Yeah. Hakeem in Sauk County has something for us. Let's go there. Hakeem, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, hi, Larry. Yeah, so my question was about hummingbirds. I thought I heard what sounded like a hummingbird. This was in April, like, you know, mid-April.
Yeah.
But I didn't see it, and it was around my feeder. It could have been, you know, a hummingbird. So I was going to ask, what's the earliest do you think hummingbirds could come to Wisconsin, southwest Wisconsin?
Well, it depends entirely on spring phenology. The first one, we put our feeder up about 10 days ago, and I had one lone ruby-throated hummingbird sitting on the feeder, tanking up about a week ago. So that would have been the third week of April. And I've not seen that bird since. But we've had everything from snow to wind and cold.
Yeah.
And I hope that poor little guy is hunkered down somewhere. But usually they're back in April. And whether they stay or whether you see them or not depends on local weather at the time.
Yeah.
So they certainly, based on the one that was at my feeder and the one you heard or saw, they're back, or at least the advanced wave is back. But I saw a bluebird on the way in this morning, the way driving into the studio, and it's supposed to warm up nicely by the weekend, 70 around here on Saturday. I suspect there'll be a big flush of bird migration over the next week or so.
Usually May 4th for the Baltimore Orioles for me. There's one that comes almost always on May 4th.
I was going to ask if you'd seen your Orioles yet. I put the jelly out almost 2 weeks ago, and nobody's touched it.
Nobody's out there. There you go, Hakeem. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, our guest today. Emeritus Professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in. Christina in Glenwood City has an issue, I think, Scott, to deal with. Hi, Christina.
Hi there, guys. I really, really hope you can help with this dilemma. I have a mother raccoon and babies living in the ceiling of my house.
Oh.
Well, Christina.
Knocked out the soffit. The babies run through the soffit. I tried trapping them with tuna, chicken eggs, but I just get cats.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Not an uncommon problem, Christina. It's unfortunate there are already young involved, but two things. Number one, I think some professional help would be worth contacting, and that involves, you know, going to your yellow pages under animal control or wildlife control and trying to figure out who's out there, whether you're anywhere near a franchise of something like critter control, or whether you could contact your nearest DNR office and ask them. They usually keep a list of members of the Wisconsin Trappers Association who help people with these kinds of problems. So look around a little bit for professional help. Number two, and most important, don't do anything personally or let anybody do anything that seals up the access and might trap them inside. Not only is that not a humane way to deal with it, but a dead adult raccoon trapped between the ceiling. I remember one case many years ago. I barely started on the job, but an elderly lady had sealed up an opening and trapped two adult raccoons over her kitchen ceiling, and they died up there. And, well, I don't want to get into the disgusting details, but it was an awful mess that required a major reconstruction and just a whole host of problems and expenses. So don't trap them inside. Even in since they're young ones, if they're not coming and going on their own yet, you can't use an excluder, usually like a hinged door if you know how they're getting in, that allows them to push their way out but not back in. But if you then trap the mother outside, the young ones are inside, that's also problematic. So my first advice is find someone who can help you and make sure they get them all out. And then once you're certain they're all out, you hear nothing more, you then have a carpenter or somebody else come in and make darn sure the house is raccoon-proof.
Yeah, there you go. That's the best way to do it, Christina. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. John in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Hello, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call.
Okay, as far as the robins go, they always like a little flat to make their nest on. And over the years, I found that, number one, one of the reasons butterflies have an eye-like markings on their wings, because the birds don't like that. I found success with making an eye about the size of my hand, making the outline of an eye, and putting that against there. But the most success I found is take a short piece of 1.5 inch or 2 inch PVC pipe and tape it onto the little ledge that they want to build on. They won't go there. They'll leave it alone.
So good idea. Yeah. And you could do the same thing with, you know, if you're at a marina, for example, you notice that most of the big poles that support the docks have metal cones on them. Mm-hmm. And that prevents gulls and other birds from simply perching on them. And again, a piece of sheet metal bent into a triangle and put whatever you can do to make it impossible for the birds to attach a pile of sticks to that top of the door or whatever they're on would do the trick. So that's a good idea. In the eye situation, you can fabricate something. You can probably print something off the internet. But there's also a device that garden centers will have called a scare eye balloon, which is like a plastic beach ball, which has great big eye spots on it, exactly the principle you're talking about, John. And you could thumbtack, blow that thing up and thumbtack it above the door. And I doubt that the robins would have any interest in coming near that. So
There you go. John, thanks a lot. Appreciate the call. By the way, you can join in, too. We have some open lines. Get you on fairly quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Kathy in Kewaskum, it's your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Yes, hi. I'm also a first-time caller, and I have a question. Originally from Kewaskum, and we moved to Tennessee for 2 years, and we're back in Kewaskum. And I cannot find any native milkweed plants in the area. The local nursery I purchased them from has gone out of business since I moved. And I'm wondering if there's any sort of resources for that, for the monarch butterflies in the native milkweed plant.
There are several.
Well, there are a number of nurseries in Wisconsin that specialize in native plants. And I think a little internet work might track that down. But also, if you can find the closest nature center, and there are many very good, very large nature centers scattered around Wisconsin, many of them have native plant sales as a fundraiser. For example, Olbrich Gardens here in Madison and the Arboretum, I think, have native plant sales. And I suspect, given the interest in people in milkweed because of monarch butterfly protection, that's something you'd be able to find. I don't know about transplanting it. It seems like it has a long route, as I recall. But again, if you're creative, if there's a roadside or a power line that's scheduled to be cut, you know, if you see the contact the town, say, hey, could I, you know, if the roadside's going to be cut or sprayed anyway, could I dig up some of these milkweeds and move them to save them? I can't imagine anyone saying no. So.
And there are other plants, by the way, that at other times of the year, monarchs need for food. And I know that nurseries like Prairie Nursery sell butterfly mixes that contain not only milkweed but other plants that they're going to need through the course of the year, through the course of the summer and fall.
It's popular enough. I'm just trying to think of where I just saw another article, whether it was in Outdoor News, where it was, on people concerned about monarchs. I would try the nature centers, but also I think it might be worth the try to talk to someone at the DNR's Natural Heritage section. They pay attention to invertebrates like butterflies and may have a contact with some of the groups that are concerned about butterflies in Wisconsin.
Yeah, you might well do that. And if you're near Milwaukee, you could come over to the Havenwood Forest on Saturday morning, where I will be. We have a WPR listener appreciation event in Milwaukee on Saturday. It's an open house from 10 to noon, and it's at the Havenwood State Forest. I wanted to get that plug in anyway, Kathy, so you gave me a chat. I have no idea, though, if they have anything in the milkweed or the butterfly mix. But I do know that many of the prairies, many of the nurseries sell specific mixes.
What's the big
Prairie Nursery is the biggest one I know.
Trying to think of the Arboretum or whatnot down by Franklin. It's not Berner Botanical Gardens. I don't think it is. I'm trying to remember the name.
Oh.
But anyway, I think with a little bit of work looking for nature centers, native nurseries, things like that, you'll be fine.
You'll get all kinds of information from them. If you type in native nurseries, native plant nurseries in Wisconsin, you're going to get seven, eight at least, and every one of them, I bet, is going to have a mix.
Well, the other person they might check with, my counterpart, I mean, I'm retired now, so I'm a little out of the loop. I'm not even sure who our horticulture specialists are, but I'm guessing whoever is the statewide horticulture specialist on campus would have such a list as well.
Yeah, there we go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Chris in LeClaire, Iowa, has something for us. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have woodpeckers in my the siding of my lake home in Delafield.
Yeah.
And that they're doing holes about two inches in a complete circumference. complete holes. And in the spring, we don't see any babies or any eggs or anything. So I don't know about nesting, but what's the deal?
It's annoying, isn't it?
They're after insects.
Oh, my gosh. We plugged one last year, and now there are two. One in the same place and one in a new place.
Well, there are a couple of reasons why the woodpeckers do that. One is territorial behavior. The males view a cabin or a home, especially if it's only periodically occupied, as just a gigantic old hollow tree. It makes a lot of noise when they hammer on it. And as they pound away attempting to attract a mate, whether it's on the siding or a TV, you know, a downspout, or I was going to say TV antenna, but who has those anymore? You know, anything that makes some sound, the woodpeckers find attractive. So that's one issue. And the other is, depending on the siding and whether it houses any insects or not, they may be after insects as a food item. And do you know what kind of siding you have on the house, Chris?
I think it's a hardy board, or either that or a cedar siding. We haven't been there for too long, but
well, the most problematic one is a product called T111 plywood siding that looks and is sometimes faced with cedar. And rather than individual boards, it's grooved about every 12 or 14 inches with a grooved routing through the plywood. So it looks like individual boards, but it's actually 4x8 sheets. And there's a construction issue with that. It's not a problem. It's just the way it's made, that there are the internal plies in the plywood don't butt tightly together. And when it gets grooved, it opens up a little tunnel, and that fills up with bugs. And the woodpeckers just work it over. But since you describe scattered, fairly large holes, I suspect that it's either a nesting attempt or territorial display or both. Either way, no matter what the cause is, you want to put an end to it. Is it all on one side of the building?
Yes.
Okay, and this is a large building, two stories, 10,000
yes.
square feet, or just a cabin?
No. It's not 10,000 square feet, but it is a large building, about, just under 2,000. Yeah. So it's a large wall with two windows on it, and they seem to like to be by the corners of the windows, which makes me think bugs.
Well, I don't think there's probably much you can do in terms of the bugs, because if they're in or under the siding, you can't really get an insecticide to them. You can check with someone who knows about that kind of thing if you wish. But I think the quickest and easiest thing you can do is try some of the scare tactics that are available. That scare eye balloon that I mentioned earlier, talking to the person with the robin nesting, is one thing. One of those at each window, just blowing in the breeze, might help. Pinwheels, little wind toy pinwheels, streamers, things like that that do some or have some motion in a slight breeze, those may help. And an owl decoy, a plastic owl decoy over each window may do the trick. But if those just sit there for weeks on end, the woodpeckers eventually figure out, oh, you know, that owl hasn't moved in the last 3 weeks. I don't think I'm going to be too worried about it. So the next step up in the battle, and I have to tell you, Chris, this is I did this for many years, and the woodpecker problem on siding was probably in the top two or three lists, so top two or three wildlife problems that I had to contend with, and it was a regular thing. So anyway, the next thing in the battle is to pick up a big sheet of plastic bird netting. Every garden center will have it. It's the very fine mesh black plastic that's used to cover a fruit tree or a row of strawberries to keep birds out. And that can be easily suspended from the roof line, or put a, you know, a nailing strip above the windows and then just staple the netting onto that and let it drape down. It's got to be away from the house a little bit, but let it drape down, and that'll physically keep the birds away. Now, if that's enough, no problem. Yeah. If they just move to the other side of the house, you're back to square one. However, again, even though these are protected birds, both by the state and the federal government, as most migratory birds are, you can get permits to deal with the birds in a lethal way. Most people don't like that idea, but if you're driven to distraction by this and it can get very expensive, then contact the USDA Wildlife Services office in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, and just tell them you're inquiring about a woodpecker permit. And usually it's not a big problem to get a permit to kill the bird.
Yeah. Most people don't want to do that.
Most people don't want to do that, but it just depends on how far the bird pushes you. And the good news is if it's territorial behavior, it's usually only one bird. If it's something else, it may be more than that. But they can be caught in a rat trap, and they'll tell you, if you're issued the permit, they'll tell you what your options are for doing the bird in. So,
and there you go, Chris.
And good luck.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Back to milkweed for a minute. Lois from DeForest called to say Jung's is carrying milkweed and other native plants. So there you go.
There you go.
Nectar plants, I should say. So there you have it. Chris in Adams has something for us. Hi, Chris.
It's a Chris's day.
Yeah.
I want to go in on top of the monarch issue, too. People don't really know this, but only about 10% of hatched larvae make it to adulthood because of predation. And so people are either raising them inside, or what I'm going to do this summer is I have the land for it. I'm going to build a butterfly kennel outside and start raising monarchs in mass, basically. But for the lady who was curious about getting started with this, there are lots of organizations on the national level that are coordinating this project. You can do this inside. It's a great summer project for kids or a church. My sister was raising them, and my elderly father, who was in his late 90s, was releasing them for her, and he was like, this is a miracle. It's a miracle. He was so enthralled by the process of dealing with this. And so there are people all over the country, in Mexico, in Canada, that have bonded together to take care of this issue. And so if you don't know what you're doing, just get involved with one of these organizations, and they have all the information on the Internet for you.
That's terrific advice. I know it's a great thing for kids. Virtually every nature center has a terrarium or whatnot with chrysalises hanging from the screen, mm-hmm. and caterpillars and whatnot. So if people don't get involved, monarchs are in deep trouble. So Chris has provided us with the means to do that.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it. And Kathy in Madison, your turn. Whoop, we lost Kathy. Let's go to Linda in Rice Lake. Hi, Linda.
Good morning. I'm calling about having fox under a tool shed in the backyard, and there are several young ones, and they all seem healthy and are running around. I have a little concern about a very small dog that uses the same backyard. My main concern is we don't want to hurt them, but we would like to figure out how to discourage them from doing this again next year and when we should do anything.
Yeah.
Well, you know, most foxes under a shed, not an uncommon issue. Mm-hmm. Foxes are doing very well in the urban environment here in the Madison area. There's a huge interest in this urban canid project and what the foxes on campus are doing and so forth. So, and they're pretty. Are they reds or grays?
Red.
Okay. So they're a beautiful animal, and they habituate to people.
And they like to eat rodents.
Yes. They'll keep your chipmunks and baby rabbits and things down. So that's a side benefit. But by all means, don't go out of your way to try and habituate them. Don't feed them. You know, don't really try and approach them. Keep them as wild as you can. And once they've left the den with the young, later on this year, sometime this summer, when you can be sure they're out and gone, then is this a huge shed or just kind of a backyard tool shed kind
of thing? Backyard tool shed.
Then I think the surefire thing to do is to spend a little time digging a trench around the shed and then putting a barrier up from the side of the shed down into the trench of galvanized wire. And
make a kind of an L.
You make an L on the bottom or put a flange on the bottom that comes out away from the shed. So if the foxes decide, oh, we'll dig down along this and get under it, they'll hit the flange and won't get under it. And then that's a permanent solution. It will also keep out skunks, woodchucks, and assorted other things yes. that will be less desirable than the foxes. But for now, I'd enjoy them, tolerate them, let them move on, and then build them out.
There you go. Good luck, Sue. Thank you. I'm sorry, Linda. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it.
The caller we lost, Kathy, I made note that she was calling to say that milkweed seeds work pretty well. And, you know, anybody's capable of, you know, walking down the roadside later on in the summer when they've gone to the pods and there's milkweed seeds blowing all over, grab a couple ripe pods and then spread those seeds in an old garden bed or whatever. It may work out just fine.
Yeah, might work out just fine. We have, let's see, Ann emailed. I wanted to get her in because she was in Madison last week and unintentionally got herself surrounded by turkeys.
I should be so lucky.
There were about a dozen in all. They didn't seem much concerned about her. She wants to know if turkeys ever injure people when they're disturbed. And I will say that I had Jeff Frederick on the show, who was the state champion turkey caller many times and does a lot of turkey decoys and stuff. And right shortly after that, someone from the Madison Police Department stopped by and had heard that show and wondered if he could get Jeff in for a meeting in Madison because some people had been, you know, had turkeys kind of run after them mm-hmm. and kind of attack them at this time of the year, and they were wondering how to deal with that. So, you know, it's the season.
Well, I mean, they're big.
Yeah.
And when a gobbler's puffed up, it looks immense. But they really are, other than maybe a few birds in the city that have become
yeah.
over-habituated to people and are pecking on windows where they see their reflection or apparently following someone, I can see where someone would get nervous. But generally speaking, turkeys are far more concerned or should be about humans than humans need to be about them. And with a couple claps of the hands or a shout or whatever, the turkeys will usually go packing. And if they don't, you know, just walk wherever you were going and walk yeah. away from them. The idea that they're going to physically attack is a remote possibility. But we learned a long time ago on the program, you never say never, but here's the deal. If you're outside, there are so many other things. Crossing the street from the parking lot to where you see the turkeys is a lot more dangerous than the turkeys are going to be. So, you know, keep relative risk in mind and enjoy the outdoors and be observant, but don't get worried about things that are just yeah. a remote possibility.
And Paul from the DNR emailed us, which was great. He had some they issued a news release this week in the DNR Weekly News on native plants, including native plant nurseries and upcoming native plant sales.
So now I remember where I saw what I was talking about.
So it's dnr.wi.gov, dnr.wi.gov. Click on the link for weekly news below top news, and you will find a listing of all those people that sell those plants. And we'll add a link. Jill's going to add a link to our website, wpr.org/Larry. Look under today's program note, and you'll get more information on that. So that's cool.
I think we've solved that problem.
I think we have. Scott Craven, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening today to the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here as we talk the world of wildlife with Scott Craven. Want to remind you once again that this Saturday I'll be at WPR's Listener Appreciation Event in Milwaukee. It's an open house. It's from 10 to noon at the Havenwood State Forest. And I've never been there, so I'm really looking forward to it. It's kind of right in town, the Havenwood State Forest, 10 to noon on Saturday. And then next week on Friday, I'm actually taking off on Thursday to drive to Bayfield. And we've got a live broadcast of Garden Talk from the 17th annual Bayfield and Bloom Garden Expo. I'll be 17 years in a row for me. You can learn more about those events at wpr.org/presents. And there you go. We're hoping to see a lot of people on Saturday at the Havenwood State Forest, and then again in Bayfield a week from Friday. Well, we have lots of callers online. I did want to bring up Bear because the last couple of weeks we've actually, Scott, had some questions from people about worried about Bear. You know, they're by the bird feeders and they're, you know, they're just kind of in the backyard in some case, parts of northern Wisconsin in particular.
Yeah, they're out now, obviously, and even, now mind you, northern Wisconsin is still a little different than southern Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Some of the big lakes are still iced over, and there's still a few snow patches. But the bears are certainly out, and after emerging from 3 months of sleeping under a tree or in a hole in the dirt—
Guess what? They're hungry.
They're hungry and grouchy and whatnot, and as a result, they cause all sorts of problems with cabin owners, homeowners, whatever— getting into the trash, the bird feeders, barbecue grills that have a big accumulation of crud on them, pet food stored outside, and a whole host of other things. So the advice is, obviously, eliminate those sources of food to the extent that you can and therefore minimize your problems. And don't, on the DNR press release that just came out a few days ago, don't feed them by any means. Yeah, they're kind of neat, and maybe they've got cubs, and they're big and fuzzy and so forth. But don't intentionally feed them. That's illegal. Don't misconstrue that or confuse that, however, with fall activity. When there's lots of food put out in the form of bait for hunting purposes, two different things, but I can see where there'd be some confusion there. The DNR offers a Living with Bears in Wisconsin publication on their website, and anyone who is faced with the problems ought to get or at least read a copy of that. And between that and a good healthy dose of common sense, should be able to take care of it. And if you've got a problem that can't be resolved, I mean, the bears coming in the kitchen window or something like that, then you can call the aforementioned USDA offices, the Wildlife Services offices, for northern issues in Rhinelander, and for southern issues in Sun Prairie, and the bears can be removed.
Let's take another call here. Sue in Milwaukee has a question for you, Scott. Let's go there. Hi, Sue.
Hi. I just wanted to call and tell you that we had great horned owls that nested in our yard this spring, and actually the day after Scott was on last month, I came home, and there was one of the babies dead on the ground, and all the feathers had been plucked from its back, we assume by a sibling. We did have one fledge, and it was very wonderful to see. He kind of hung around the yard for a few days, but he only appeared to have one parent that fed him. Is that the typical thing? And I'll just hang up now and listen to your comments.
You know, I don't. I think that both parents usually stay involved. But whether something unfortunate came the way of one of the parents, which happens. In my travels around the state, I've seen over the last month or so a number of raptors, including great horned owls, you know, dead on the road. They swoop down for something at night and wham, hit by a car. So accidents, these things don't live forever. So that's a possibility, but if there was a short food supply, for example, maybe the sibling rivalry is a little easier to explain. Who knows? But the bottom line is if the remaining parent or the only one you're seeing is successfully raising that healthy young, then all's well that ends well.
Yep. There you go. Thank you so much for calling. And Adam in Deerfield, hello.
Hi, Larry and Scott. You were just talking about red or about fox. And when I live in the rural area in Deerfield, we've got a couple acres, and we had some fox around here, and a neighbor away on the other side of the hill, he's got some chickens, and apparently some of their chickens were getting picked off. Well, this guy found the den, and they poured gas down in the den, and they had little kits and everything and killed everything. We saw them here a couple of times around our property, and it was just really neat. I'm wondering, is there a way to try to attract them? Because we really appreciated them. Like you had indicated, they're excellent as far as rodent control, and that's my question.
Well, I'm pleased to hear you're sympathetic toward the local foxes, but a fox has a tough life, and with a neighbor willing to go to the illegal, unethical, and inhumane aspects of burning out a den, you've got a bit of a problem there that may be difficult to resolve. I certainly hope someone who knew about that reported it, but I don't know. We'll leave that at that. But that's a bad thing. But realize, too, that red fox are persecuted by coyotes, and they've become very common also in the urban fringes. And they're also, of course, trapped for their fur. So there are a number of things that keep a fox on edge. They also wander over quite a large area. So the fact that you have kind of a two-acre sanctuary does not necessarily mean that that's adequate to hold a fox or pair of foxes or whatever. Depending on what else is around you, besides the den burner, if you're near a park, greenway, open space, or whatever, you may see an occasional fox and have to be happy with that. I mean, what they're looking for is some degree of security or sanctuary and an abundant food supply. You can only work with the food supply indirectly by tolerating high vole years or lots of chipmunks around or something like that. But feeding them directly is not something that you should think about doing. So your options, bottom line, Adam, it's an admirable goal, but your options are pretty limited.
Yeah.
If you've got the environment that might be suitable for them, chances are they'll show up. But there's, you know, in terms of active steps of providing more food, that would be very difficult. Trying to modify the habitat on your 2 acres, you know, other than, you know, some structure or log pile or something like that, they might find suitable and secure for a den site. There's just not a whole lot you can do, but be tolerant of them when you do see one.
Yeah, there you go.
And try and preach that tolerance around the neighborhood.
Yeah, absolutely. Kathy and Antigo, hello to you.
Hi. I just wanted to suggest to the lady that had the coons in her ceiling. We've had that twice, and we put a light up there, and the fowl will move her babies because of the light.
Well, that's certainly a possibility, Kathy. I've heard it used before, along with a few other things I'll mention in a second, but it really depends on the architecture. If they only really need to move on the other side of a joist or, you know, across a wall partition into another ceiling area, that may not help, but the light's a possibility. People have also had good luck with naphthalene, which is a moth flake repellent product. Naphthalene is generally repellent to all mammals, and it's easier to spread around than the light would be. Same thing with ammonia on a rag. And also sometimes people report good luck with putting a, you know, the little portable radio or something up there and picking out a hard rock station or something. And, you know, that may cause them to say, hey, let's find a better spot, or at least somebody who's playing better music. But be careful, anybody who's listening who's thinking, ooh, naphthalene or ammonia, I'll give that a try. Remember that those smells are as noxious to you or anyone else in the house as they may be to the raccoon. So be careful you don't overdo something and make the place uncomfortable for you as well as the raccoon. Yeah. Same thing with the hard rock, I guess. Anyway.
There you go.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much, Kathy, for calling. Appreciate it. You know, one thing, before we break for news today, I wanted to talk about bats, because we are in a terrible situation with our bats.
We are. The data are in from the 2019 winter surveys, and our cave bats, like little browns, big browns, and so forth, have been wiped out at some hibernation sites, gone completely. And at the others surveyed, they were reduced anywhere from 72 to 97%. So those cave bats, and you know, not talking about the tree bats like red bats and hoary bats and so forth, a different situation. But for those cave bats, which were by far the more numerous of our species, they're in deep trouble from white nose syndrome. We expected this. It was inevitable it would get here from the discovery in New York. Now the DNR wants the public to report barns, bat houses, any place where survivors are showing up so that they can monitor these and know where the populations are sustaining themselves. Go to DNRbats@wisconsin.gov. And you can report these things and also volunteer in other ways to help the bats that are still alive.
Yeah, it's a bad situation. Sad, very, very sad situation. Well, Scott Craven, our guest today, he's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. So we'll take your calls, your questions, and your comments. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Take a look at the news now and weather. Find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. And then we'll be back to talk more about the world of wildlife in Wisconsin. Stay with us. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining in today. If you have a question or a comment, maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Richard in Superior has a question for you, Scott, so let's go there. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a question on not getting rid of animals, but I am interested in seeing what a person could do about getting more snowshoe rabbits back in northern Wisconsin. They just seem to have disappeared in the last 20 years.
Well, this is, I'm not going to give you the kind of information you're hoping for, Richard, because like the fox issue we dealt with earlier, it's not sometimes easy to attract some species. It's not like, gee, I'd like more woodpeckers, so I'm going to put out a suet feeder on the deck, and all of a sudden there are the woodpeckers. There are a couple of things with snowshoe rabbits. Do you own some property, Richard?
No, but I live in Douglas County, which is the richest county in the state, I think, for public land.
Well, the snowshoe rabbits tend to, well, there's two issues with them. Number one, they're cyclic. So kind of like rough grouse, they come and go about every 10 years. So the population peaks, and then it slowly declines, and then in 5 years it bottoms out, and then it slowly rises again to get back up to where they're relatively numerous. Depending on where in the cycle you're looking around or your experience, they may be very scarce, and a few years later they're relatively abundant. And there's little or nothing you can do to change that. It's a phenomenon of their population dynamics, like it is for grouse. However, you can mitigate that cyclic fluctuation in really good habitat. So a really good habitat for grouse or for snowshoe hares will tend to hold more even in a low year than lousy habitat. And snowshoes are creatures of early successional, you know, cutover harvested forests with dense undergrowth, a lot of balsam and whatnot coming in, thick undergrowth. And if, I don't know what the logging or timber harvest history is in Douglas County, but on a lot of our public lands, that's kind of slowed down over recent years. And if the forests are not being cut and harvested, that's another reason why snowshoes in your experience may seem more scarce than they were in the past. And you know, other than you can't, as an individual, you can't do much to affect timber values or the timber markets or whatever else. That's just a sign of the times. It could swing the other way for some reason, and then you'll see more snowshoes. But you could also, in terms of the rough grouse cycle, there are some glitches right now. We were supposedly on the upswing, headed for a high here in several years. The snowshoe hare should be following that. So things may get better, and you may see more of them for a while.
Yeah, for sure.
But there's little you can do as an individual, especially without property that you're managing.
And thanks a lot for calling, Richard. Appreciate it. You know, Buffalo County has been in the news here recently. Scott, you want to talk about that?
Well, what happened, and I think is what you're referring to, Larry, is that their Citizens Deer Advisory Committee, so-called CDAC, every county has one. This was a development that came online after the Deer Czar report back 5 or 6 years ago. And these citizen committees are tasked with developing recommendations on the deer populations in their county that then go on up the line to the Natural Resources Board for action. So one thing that they're asked to do is decide right up front with citizen input from the county that they're in, and presumably the members of the committee represent different interests like forestry, highways, hunter groups, farmers, whatever. Do they want more deer in the county, less deer, or maintain the population? And a number of counties are in a situation where they've just got what they feel is a way more deer than they want or need. It's the case in Buffalo County, among others. So they've been, I think that they've had, I'm trying to think as far as Buffalo is concerned. I think they were looking at the last 5 years, they've recommended a decrease and presumably try to increase the issuance of permits and so forth, and they've not had any impact on the population. It continues to grow. So out of frustration, if you want to continue to decrease the herd, well, you've got to be able to do something. Well, what can you do? You could issue many thousands of permits, but if the hunters in the county or the landowners are either not allowing them to be used or don't want to use them, you could issue 10 million permits. It wouldn't make any difference. That's the situation we're in Dane County, where I'm a member of the CDAC here in Dane County. So the toolbox, when you go to the toolbox, so to speak, to figure out, all right, what are we going to do to decrease the herd, there's not much left in there. One of the things that's left is a very radical, serious choice to go to an antlerless-only hunting season. Mm-hmm. In other words, the hunters in Buffalo County would not be able to shoot anything other than antlerless deer. No bucks. That, you know, you're, as a deer hunter, that drives people.
We've had an experience of that in the state years back.
There have been experiences like that, but it's considered a very radical approach right now, and the heat is on when that recommendation is made. We talked about it in Dane County for about 7-8 seconds and realized, no, we're not doing that. It's pointless. But Buffalo County, to the credit of the people on the CDAC, I think the vote was 4-1, said, all right, we're going to recommend an antlerless-only season from our deliberations, and that's what we're sending up to the Natural Resources Board. Well, you can imagine what happened. Buffalo County is the leading county for harvest of trophy deer bucks in the country. A lot of land is leased. There are a lot of guides and outfitters and whatnot. Everybody's just going nuts over this. The people on the CDAC committee have admitted that, you know, we don't really think this is going to happen, and it probably won't. But at least it may start some more awareness and discussion that there's a problem. Some areas just have too many deer, and there are no good tools to do anything about it.
Yeah.
So they're hoping that this will get the board and the DNR and everybody else thinking about what else can we do, and maybe some good will come of it. But I don't think, despite the fact that I give them credit for a lot of guts and good thinking, I think the chances of it happening are pretty slim.
Slim and none.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about elk tags? we've got time is here for that, isn't it?
I think it's May Day, and May 1st marks the start of the issuance. It goes until the end of the month. From now until the end of the month, Wisconsin hunters, resident hunters, can apply for a permit to harvest a bull elk. This will be the second year of the hunt in northern Wisconsin where elk have been restored. The quota is 10 animals. Five of the tags are reserved for the Ojibwe tribes. Five are reserved for sport hunters. And one of the five is turned over to the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, a valuable partner in this whole restoration effort, and they raffle off number five. The other four are allocated through this drawing that the DNR administers. It's $10 for the application, and you can only get one, and you go into the pot. Last year they had, what was the number? I think it was just over 38,000 people paid the $10 to get a chance at hunting a bull elk. And they did fill the tags, by the way, last year. So success rate is, it's a good chance if you get one. The odds are not good. But anyway, most people feel, hey, for $10, it's worth the try. It'd be a lifetime experience, once-in-a-lifetime experience. So that starts again today. And in addition to your one shot at the $10 application with the DNR, you can buy raffle tickets from the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation on that number five tag. You can buy as many as you want.
Yeah.
So if you want to improve your odds a little bit, you know, I thought sure I had that $750 million Powerball pot a few weeks ago, but it didn't work out for me. But here's a chance to draw an elk tag. It's a big deal. The program is going very well. This also marks, in the world of elk, the last Kentucky transfer has now been made, or those elk have been captured and whatnot. Yeah. So that program with Kentucky is over. We've got what we've got, and we'll see how the herds grow now. And then there was a fair bit of publicity just in the last couple of days about the last elk from the original 1995 release, where we got elk from the Pigeon River area in Michigan that started this whole. She just died. It was a cow, almost 25 years old.
Yeah, a wonderful story. Not that she died, but it, wonderful that she lived 25 years.
Yeah, that is old for an animal that depends on its teeth. When they get worn out, you're pretty well at the end of the line.
Ann in Green Bay, we'll give you a chance now. Thank you for calling, Ann.
Oh, yes, and happy May to both of you.
To you as well.
We enjoy your program so much. I have a comment and a question.
Okay.
My comment is about the peepers that you talked about in the early part of your program.
Yeah.
We were in Bannage Harbor over the weekend, and in a rather remote area near the ridges, and the peepers, about 9 o'clock at night, I stepped out to hear them, and it was almost hurt my ears. It was just so loud and deafening, but they are out and about for sure up there. And then my question comes from Green Bay, where last year we had a mother duck, mallard, sitting on a nest right outside a window. She's a pretty smart little girl because she chose a great spot, sort of under an eave and under the bushes, but didn't she sat there for a long time and then disappeared, and so the eggs grew cracked. But so something got them, and yet here she is back again. Now, could it be the same duck, or would it be instinct for other ducks to come in there? But there she is, and we are trying to protect her because we admire her tenacity, sitting there day after day, hour after hour. And how long do we protect her?
Well, it certainly could be the same duck. They're reasonably faithful to a nest site. And so let's assume, for the sake of sensitivity and joy of nature, it's the same duck. And whatever got the nest last year but didn't get her, probably a raccoon or whatever, she was unsuccessful. She left. She's back again, giving another try. Now, is she sitting on a full clutch of eggs at this point?
We saw three, but she's pretty good about covering them up with leaves when she leaves the nest. So it's rather hard to get to her. We don't want to bother her. But we did see three.
It sounds like if she had three, that's not a full clutch, and there should be 10 or a dozen by the time she's through, laid at a rate of about one a day or a little slower than that. So it'll take a while to complete the clutch. Then she'll start to incubate. And what, assuming all goes well, they'll all hatch synchronously, and whoosh, she'll march them off, and they'll be gone. You may or may not ever see that. You'll find the nest, basically the shells left behind, and everybody's gone. And there are some ways. Is it possible that that's what happened last year, by the way?
Well, maybe so. We because we saw the shells and we didn't see her, we just thought, but maybe, okay, hopefully that is what happened.
Yeah. It was typically, I don't know how they do this, but they usually hatch very early in the morning. The ducklings only stay in the nest for as long as it takes for them to dry out, and then mom's going to take them out of there and lead them to the nearest water. Mm-hmm. And so let's assume, for the sake of joy of nature and whatnot, she hatched successfully last year. There was no disaster. She's still alive and back and in the process of raising a second brood. So there you go. Keep your eyes open. And if you get a chance to see them leaving, you can provide a bit of an escort. But beyond that, let them go their way.
Yeah,
but there was some help.
JJ emailed to say that the Green Bay Duck Hunters Association has a duck rescue program that will help relocate urban nesting mallards and ducklings. So in your case, Ann, you kind of want to keep them around, but if you happen to see some ducks, a mom out there with a bunch of little ones, and they look like they're in danger from the road or whatever, you can call the Green Bay Duck Hunters Association, and they have a duck rescue program to help relocate urban nesting mallards and ducklings.
Well, there you go. And I guess for other people not in Green Bay who may face this or see a brood or a few ducklings, you know, caught on a gutter on the roadside or something like that, if the whole brood is seemingly in a bad situation and the hen, the female, is still with them, they can be captured and taken to the nearest marsh or wetland or whatever where they'll be safe. But the key in that is they have to be at great risk, and you have to capture the hen first with a dip net or whatever. If she's caught in a corner of a building, capture the hen, then gather up the ducklings in a box, put them together, go to your wetland. But then the reverse is true. Let the little guys go first. They'll all gather in a ball peeping. Then let the hen go. She'll go to them, and away they'll all go. If you let the hen go first, she may fly off. That's not good.
Yeah.
So anyway, just follow that order. And if it's a situation where the hen was obviously, say, killed in the road, the ducklings are frantically scrambling around on the roadside, catch them. If you can't find an outfit like the Green Bay Duck Hunters who are taking care of them, get them to a local marsh where there are other broods. And if there's a brood of similar age, they'll usually be adopted.
Yeah, so there you go. Thank you so much for that call. Appreciate your call. And you could join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Always love to hear from our listeners. And we've got a few more things that we can talk about here. Keeping critters out of the garden. You have, Scott, a swarm. I don't know, swarm's not the right word for the gophers or chipmunks or squirrels and so forth.
Well, I'm under siege this year from chipmunks and gray squirrels. We've always had a few squirrels, and you know, my wife likes the squirrels, and a squirrel or two, nay, no problem. But we've had as many as 9 at a time on the feeders, which is, in my opinion,
too many
excessive squirrel numbers. But they're only a problem now in going through an awful lot of sunflower seed. The garden issues that people will start facing rather quickly as they get their gardens established once it warms up is to just make sure that the gardens are relatively protected from rabbits, deer, woodchucks, things like that, that can devastate a garden pretty quickly. And I would just recommend that you consider up front either repairing or replacing or improving whatever fence you have, or putting up a fence if you don't have a fence. That's the number one line of defense. Repellents and trapping and everything else are time-consuming, expensive, and just difficult for you. The fence is really the go-to for that. And I can assure you, if you're new to gardening, you may not think you're going to have a problem, but you will. Rabbits are everywhere. So that's just something to think about as you're spending money on plants, which have, by the way, my observation is garden plants have become quite expensive over the years.
But,
anything that's eaten by a rabbit is a source of great frustration.
Bob in Land O'Lakes, what's on your mind today?
How you doing, guys? I just had a quick comment. You know, Scott, you were talking about the tools to control the level of the deer herd. And I understand, you know, hunting is obviously the biggest one we have. But land management is also a big one. And I have to say, you know, I've been 35 years working up in northern part of the state as a forester, seeing the impact of the deer herd on forest regeneration.
Yes.
Pretty amazing. And we're way above, you know, sustainable levels in terms of impact on the forest. And one of the things that you look at the American Legion Northern Island State Forest, and, you know, they keep about 30% of that forest in pioneer aspen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so just that alone is creating huge amounts of browse for those animals. And, you know, if they would just let the forest develop into later cereal stages. And I understand for jack pine and on some of these drier sites, you have to practice even age management and all the rest. But we have an unnecessarily large part of the percentage of our forest that is maintained in aspen. And that's a big part of why we have so many deer. We just have so much habitat for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true in certain parts of the state. I thought your problem was going to be mitigated a little bit the way the winter started to shape up in February, but the reports I was reading yesterday suggested that the winter severity levels were both brief and only reached severe or very severe levels in some very small parts of the state. So apparently the deer herd came through what was shaping up to be a pretty nasty winter situation, came through it reasonably well. So that's not going to help much in terms of the kind of forest regeneration problems you're seeing, but we'll see where it all goes.
Yeah, we'll see where it all goes for sure, Bob. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And with that, we are out of time, Scott. Thank you so much. You're going to be back next month, too. That's great.
Yes, I'm
June 5th.
Filling in for Jamie and David, and I'll be here next month and perhaps even the month afterwards. So
that's perfect. Scott Craven, our guest today, an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. He will be back on June 5th, and we'll do this all over again. I know there's going to be plenty to talk about. Tomorrow at this time, our birding expert, Bill Volkert, will be back to give us an update on spring migration. So we'll talk a little bit more with him about migration. That's tomorrow at 11. In the meantime, hey, thanks so much for listening. And please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.